Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Midnight Feast Rock and Roll Special. I'm Gareth Briley. I'm joined here by Bernadette Russell.
Hello. We're really excited about the stories on the theme of rock and roll that we've got coming up for you this evening. So, sit back, get comfortable.
Drink some wine or beer.
Maybe a joint. That'd be quite rock and roll.
All right. Wouldn't
it? Enjoy. We Two Kings by Emily Williams. It's 1985. Mum is listening to Stevie Wonder's I Just Called as she potters in the kitchen. I'm sitting up at the table, pushing the last pieces of fried egg around my plate. That man owes the king a debt, my dad says, accompanied by the scraping of a chair on the tiled floor. He sweeps one of his laser white suits from the dryer and checks it over for missing rhinestones. I turn around to see my father's eyes blinking from beneath the king's sculpted quiff, secured with 15 hairpins and a lot of L'Oreal Elviv. I know because I had to hunt for them, and the kitchen is foggy with a sticky aftertaste of hairspray. That night, Elvis reads me my bedtime story in a northern Staffordshire accent before going out to thrill the crowds at the Corporation Club. Christmas, 1989. I'm backstage, though only my father calls it that, draining the life from a carton of Umbongo while I wait for my dad to call me up, a very special guest. At his signal, I stride out onto the stage, concentrating very hard on where to stand and trying to keep my balance even though the quiff has sent me off kilter and is almost covering my eyes. I don't look at the people sitting out there, just my dad, so that I don't miss my cue. I wait for my line, in the ghetto, and I sing it like an angel, like a rock and roll Alid Jones. I'm shocked at how my voice sounds through an amplifier, but the audience loves it. June 1997, We Two Kings is a hit. We've moved on from working men's clubs to small theatres and the occasional nightclub gig. It's what he's always longed for. But the success is not making my dad happier. On stage, we sparkle together. We've got a repartee going, and our duelling Elvis medley is always a hit. But when the gig is over, I feel bad for him when the promoters and the punters say things like, "Great to have both the young and the old Elvises on stage at the same time." They wink at me and nod at my father. And the women. He was never unfaithful, but you'd be surprised at what spandex does for the primmest of the Rotary set. Never a drag or sit in the house, my dad used to say to me, once I was old enough to understand. But now it's always me they come up to at the end of the set, usually in threes or fours, nudging each other and giggling, wanted to try on my wig. Go on, give us a And then they all fall away laughing. Two phone numbers. Every gig. Always the quiet ones, though. Sometimes the promoters catch me alone, ask me whether I'm interested in doing a solo show or being part of a supergroup they've got going, a Sinatra, an Orbison, an Elvis. I say no, I can't for now. But I know that there's nowhere else for We Two Kings to go. We've peaked. Sarah's pregnant, the bills aren't going to stop, and there's only so many times you can play the same circuit. December 1998. I've done it. I told him this Christmas would be our last festive run, and after that I was going solo. He seemed to take it all right at first, but at the end of our next show, he disappeared after suspicious minds, leaving me to tackle the rest of the set alone. I did well, the audience went wild, and I found him later in the bar, his wig off, and a bomber jacket over his costume. From the back he looked like any of the other men there, drinking alone, looking for answers in the bottom of his glass. I pulled up a chair next to him.
I made you, son,
he growled.
One day that boy of yours will turn his back on you just like you've done to me.
Christmas, 2004. I keep the king out of my home. Sometimes my mum said she didn't know whether she was married to Brian or Elvis, so all my gear is kept in the car, apart from when it needs washing. I get ready at the venue, and I don't know that Sarah's seen me in my full kit for years. She's Not a fan, really. And my son, Johnny, certainly hasn't. I once left a sideburn on by accident, and when I looked in on him to kiss him goodnight, he screamed so loudly that Sarah thought there was an intruder. I didn't make that mistake again. But Dad has been plotting. Yesterday, Boxing Day, he set the karaoke machine up and sent Johnny out of the room to get ready. 5 minutes later, he came back in with a quiff, sideburns and rhinestones and launched into a perfect rendition of Heartbreak Hotel. Well, as near a perfect as a six-year-old can manage. The family threw Quality Street at him and demanded an encore. My father must have been training him for weeks. That's what Saturday afternoons putting practice at the driving range were. We'll give him credit. It was a success. The family were in tears. Except for my father, who sat there, nursing his Baileys and smiling at me.
That's brilliant.
That was We Two Kings by Emily Williams.
Thank you,
Fantastic.
Emily.
Fantastic.
This next story is by Joel Shea, and it's called The Best Band is the One You're In. The first band I formed was the freest, but not the best. I started this band with Shane. We had an offensive name, technology beyond our means, and a sort of confidence that came from not caring. We played as many shows as we could, as a duo, trio, and then as a larger, more traditional lineup, going from industrial metal to stoner rock in the space of 3 years or so. People came and went, usually because of things I did. These were the days when I would smash things and throw bottles at people's heads. Our music was never recorded. There were no t-shirts. We couldn't afford that. I was on welfare and getting more serious about drugs. And one day, I showed up at our bass player's house where we practiced and took my pedals, my guitars and my gigantic amplifier, loaded them into my mother's husband's van and quit. They went on to become quite interesting. There was, somewhere in those months, also a basement drums and guitar duo I had going with Troy. It was hard work and I wasn't ready to stop being an idiot yet. Troy had a good life, and I think I was an irritant. I moved back to Vancouver from Victoria then and brought my gear with me. I tried to join a hardcore band, but they were way, way beyond me. I discovered crack, and I lost my pedals, my amp, and all but one guitar. Back in Victoria, I washed up at Troy's and begged him to take me in. He refused and tried to have myself committed. The hospital instead referred me to the detox centre at the house beside my ex-girlfriend's. I brought my guitar and I began to play again. The detox sent me up island to Courtney. I did 28 days with loggers and fishermen who were drying out from heroin. I made us sing the national anthem at breakfast times. It was sometimes very good there, and musical. I took my guitar back to Victoria and stayed in Jay's basement. I had welfare coming in again, so I had a lot of spare time. I kind of went nuts and ended up in Pittsburgh. I tried a few new things. I played some gigs as a singer-songwriter. I made my first American dollar there and threw it off the bridge beside Allegheny Prison later that night. That all went south, and I was in Toronto for a while. I bought a four-track and some pedals, a synthesizer, and a granny organ with a drum machine. I made some songs and put them on the internet. They were quite bad. I was staying in the half-demolished townhouse where I was working, sleeping on wrap bales of insulation and eating the owner's leftovers. Fighter jets went over the house, practicing for a ceremony just in case the city won its Olympics bid. Had a lot of ideas, energy, and optimism. For some reason, I saved up some money and went back to Pittsburgh. I formed the Couriers de Bure there. We had a power trio. I had a Dane Electro 59 DC. Grant played the drums and Bob played the bass. We played the Mr. Roboto project twice, made a demo and rehearsed in a real space. I blew up the owner's amp, smashed the Dane Electro. Grant got married and Bob went wild and disappeared. Becoming a camp cook at a hunting lodge in the interior of BC seemed like a good idea. The money was big. I got really good at making bread there, but a cowboy pointed his rifle at me, and I was lonely in a terrible way. I collected 3 weeks' pay and was back in Vancouver, down to nothing but one guitar again. Tyler and I formed Antique City in Vancouver. We played slow, sad music. Tyler taught me how to sing harmony. She's one of the most beautiful voices I've ever heard. She played great keyboards too. Later on, Max played upright bass with us, and that so was fun. Then things went very bad between Max and his girlfriend, and he went away to Toronto. Marco joined us on the last lap in Max's place. He was a big guy and he moved a lot on stage. He was also a good producer. Tyler worked really hard to put on this show where I smashed a guitar on stage. I was a dick to both of them and the audience. That ended us, they told me, as much the next day at Tyler's house. I walked home feeling punctured. I was washing dishes at the restaurant where Kirsta worked, and we made a noise record with keyboards and kalimbas and other toys that nobody had ever heard. He smokes a lot of weed. Rachel was a Londoner, a classic pianist and a good writer. We met in Vancouver, made 2 CDs there, and a bit of money playing shows as Mavina Helena. Her visa expired, and I came over here. We formed a band right after the show at the Spitz, with Andy on bass and Dave playing drums. Kirsta got a visa, and MH was briefly his backing band while he tried to make it in the big city. As fun as it was at times, I never felt like I was getting what I wanted with this band. There were some big fights. It ended with my marriage. I rented a room at Rosie's house where I tried to glue my life back together. Andy decided I got a second chance and agreed to begin a new band with me. Owen had also agreed to try out with the keyboard I had loaned him. He'd never been in the band. We played a few weeks with some really wet drummers, and then Rosie piped up about playing metal as a teenager. On New Year's Eve, Bannex met for the first time in a shitty rehearsal studio in Shoreditch. We then spent our time confronting London in every way we could. We took monosyllabic slabs of rhythm and threw them at people who often shook their heads. I came around to the galvanising spirit of my first band again. It was physical. Andy moved to Japan and we knew without him, it was over. London is more musical than one person could ever know. Somewhere in the million of notes being played every day here, there are mine, and those are the women and men who I am lucky to play with. Maybe we'll see you around. Please, bring earplugs. Joel Shea, brilliant. The best band is the one you're in, by Joel Shea. Thank you, Joel.
Thanks, Joel. This is Last Night a DJ Saved His Life, by Alan McCormick. Amidst the throng of a South London high street, he mouthed Noel Edmonds at a white sports car blasting ELO into the blue sky. His mouthing was cartoonly graphic and didn't pass unnoticed. Soon there was the sound of screeching brakes and the slamming of a tiny door. "Did you mouth Noel Edmonds at me?" The voice was familiar, the jumper zigzag and colourful, the beard well-kempt and gnomish. He decided to pretend that the Noel Man wasn't there by seeking the off switch. When Noel Man's first punch landed, he was transported back to the safety of Diddy David Hamilton, the near-forgotten radio voice of Middle England, saying, "That's all, folks," at the end of a programme he loved as a child. Alan Freeman interrupted to record the next punch in a loud rock and roll baritone, as if the fight's commentary was being scrambled from an old 70s wireless. Soon he was being dragged onto the road for an old-school DJ kick-in. Noel Man wore blue suede shoes and their soft upper cushion probably saved his life. To rescue his sensibilities from the Jeremy Clarkson of his day, the coddlesome hairy cornflake, he allowed status quo to shake him down. In faded jeans, plummeting out of a small-town discotheque, rock and rolling all over the world, he fell into a hazardous state of musicless slumber. Later he heard the treacle salivation of every household's favourite son, Simon Master Bates, on the ambulance radio, telling some sob story to Leo Sayers, "I won't let the show go on." Of the violence he remembered nothing. The bruises on his face and arms rationalised as marks of a romantic musical accident in the street. 10 cc's, I'm not in love, scampering around his mind and across his lips. From the trendy nurses' station, tuned to Radio 6, he later heard the twittering of Manchester DJs Radcliffe and McConey.
Mr. Morrissey lived at number 22. Their first single got to 22, and he first met guitarist Nara in a pub in Salford, also 22. Funny pub, that. Didn't the barman keep a stuffed dog behind the bar? Jack Russell? Not the wicket keeper, surely. No, but the landlord might have been a whippet keeper.
Weeks seemed to pass as they warbled on. And then came the salvation. Hello, lovely. It was an uncommonly nice voice, a kittenish Kate Bush voice. Are you the man with the child in your eyes? No hint of chiding. It was as if she really wanted him to man up and join her. His pinkies twitched underneath the blanket in response, the best he could muster. She bent over in her crisp physio uniform, craned close, the hint of apple soap, and whispered, "Lover, please, please come back," into his ear, and his little ear hairs collected themselves and waved back. She touched his arm before she left, her long, delicate fingers. How he wanted them to brush all over his skin, reaching over to retune the radio. Radio 3, the therapeutic station of choice, a theme, the sea. Gambo's twee, twerpy Americanisms introducing male as fifth. Dangerous, melancholic music to lose yourself in and drift away. Christ, he could have cried when a boat horn cut through the fog of strings, and he imagined, perhaps through a memory of the Dagietto movement in the film of Death in Venice, St. Mark's grand, faded buildings emerging into view as he approached Venice from the grey expanse of sea. He was alone in a topsy-turvy gondola, the enfeebled Gustav von Eschenbach feverishly fantasising about his tuxedo, the aquiline Polish voice satisfyingly and momentarily replaced in his mind by his singing physiotherapist. The blanket draped across his lap, dampened in the rough, the sea chucking up, his heart beating in time with the waves punching against the boat. This time he was able to press the buzzer in time to call for help. Later, back in the garden at home, Radio 4 voices muttered from the kitchen, a middle-class morphine dulling the pain of his body and mind. A large dog fox appeared as a dishevelled Niall Edmonds approached him across the lawn, slinky and raddled at the same time, his bearded jaw bruised and collapsing at the edges to show two yellow canine teeth, sharp and dagger-like. The Noel Edmonds dog fox spoke first. "You should never have said my name." "Never used it. I mouthed it."
"Semantics, you deserved your kicking."
"You're not a fox at all, are you?"
"I am, and I can bite."
The Noel Edmonds dog fox jumped at him with a scream. He fell back in his chair, so the Noel Edmonds dog fox jumped over him and into the kitchen. He managed to crawl over to close the kitchen door. The Noel Edmonds dog fox was furious and slathered and snarled at the window, making mucky, sticky kisses against the pane. The Archer started up on the radio, its prosaic rural theme tune having the effect of making him feel tired and dead at the same time. He was glad to be outside with a wild beast and the banal drama left to compete inside. "Turn it over," he shouted at the Noel Edmonds dog fox, who did as he was told and suddenly was out in the night and on the street again. He saw a white sports car speeding towards him, music throbbing from its sides and pounding from its floor. A tall, beardless man with impressive Lego hair climbed out of the driver's side.
"Hi, fella. I'm Mike Reed."
"The music? It's familiar. What is it?"
"Bow Wow Wow."
"Where snakes in the grass are absolutely free."
"You got it."
"Travelling Wilburys."
"Roy Orbison."
"Roy Orbison, thank you."
"Rock and roll. That's your prescription from now on."
"You're a musical doctor."
"I'm Dr. Feelgood."
"I'm glad all over." "Yes, I am."
"Yes,
you are."
Alan McCormick, wow.
With Last Night a DJ Saved His Life. Thank you, Alan.
This next story is called It's Still Rock and Roll by Paul Golden. It happened so quickly. A curt order, a grunted reply, a raised voice, and then, "You just don't understand." And the teenager stormed out. And that was it. Sunday lunch at the grandparents' ruined, with everyone reduced to an embarrassed silence whilst a hooded boy sat at the end of the garden, head nodding in time to music only he could hear. His father got up to deal with his son, but instead the grandfather just put a hand out and said, "Leave it to me." But instead of going out into the garden, he went into the hall and was heard rummaging around in the loft. He emerged a few minutes later with an extension cable and two rectangular boxes. He plugged the cable in, threaded it through the open window, and then went outside to collect the other end. And with this in his hand, he walked to the end of the garden. The boy looked up suddenly, and he put the boxes on the garden bench, and when the older man tapped his ear, the boy took the headphones out. It seemed more difficult to be rebellious to his grandfather. Then the older man opened the box and connected a plug to the cable. And from the other, he carefully selected a vinyl disc. The motor on the Dansett Junior record player normally needed warming up before playing, but it should be okay. He placed the disc on the spindle and carefully placed a needle at the disc's edge. There's a crackle and some staccato chords before the singing started. "Wake up, little Susie. Wake up." A few more chords and then it was repeated. "Wake up, little Susie. Wake up." The older man let the first few lines come out before speaking. It's about a bloke and his girlfriend who fell asleep at a film and they realise they're going to get into trouble. He paused. "Ring any bells?" The boy sighed. "It's not fair. We're only talking. We just forgot the time."
"Only talking. Is that what they call it nowadays?"
There was no answer. And they listened for a minute or so until the song ended. The needle was carefully taken off before the grandfather spoke again.
I'm gonna give you a very useful piece of information. It's up to you how you use it. Let me take you back to 1985, and there's a Norwegian band called A-ha on the charts with a song called Take On Me. The girls go crazy for the lead singer with his chiseled jaw, muscles and blonde highlights. Anyway, your father decides that this is the look he needs to impress his current girlfriend. Bear in mind, this is a chubby, dark-haired lad from Nottingham. So I get a call from a bloke saying he's with your dad in A&E, and can I explain why he poured asbestos in his eyes and ruined their new bathroom towels and matched with bleach? The beginning of a smile started to appear in the boy's face. His grandfather put the song on again. It didn't last very long with that girl. And after I bawled him out, me and your father didn't speak for a week. Longest week I ever spent. Felt awful about it, but he needed to learn. This song was playing the first time I got my hand in your nan's bra. And don't pull a face like that. You think you've invented it. Her dad gave me such a clout when he caught us. Then my dad clouted in, and then me. And it was nearly a month before he grunted at me, "You come to the football on Saturday." And things went back to normal. Me and your nan had to see each other on the quiet for a year or so, but we got there. The record played away to itself for a few seconds before his grandson asked, "So what happens now?" "Where are you going? You apologise to your mum, dad and nan, and then we have Sunday lunch." There was a final bit of defiance as his grandson said, "We've gone cold by now." His grandfather shook his head. "Nah, your nan had put ours in the oven. Come on, let me carry this back in." And together they packed up the record player and the box of records and walked side by side back to the house. "So what did your dad have?" the grandson asked. "Now that is a very good question. Not sure. He was down at the mines at 14, so damn sure it wasn't a record player. But that's a good question, because whatever you've done, we've all done it before, and probably better. I had the Everly Brothers, your dad had A-ha, and you've got, well, whatever that is. he said, pointing at the headphones. His grandson held out one of the earphones, and though it felt a bit odd putting something in your ear that had been in someone else's, the older man listened and then nodded his head.
Yeah, it's all right. Although you know they're using the bass line from Every Breath You Take by the Police from 1983.
His grandson raised his eyebrows, and his grandfather said, that's my point. Music growing up, it all changes, but it's all the same. What you got to learn is what we all had to learn, how to play the game. Now, come on, I'm famished. Thank you, that was Paul Golden, and it's still rock and roll. Thank you, Paul.
This is Angel of the Alamo by Julie Ballou. They were 5 weeks into their American tour when English new romantic pop group Millie and the Meows arrived in San Antonio, Texas. It was 1981 and disco was yet to appear in town, so the gender-bending hedonistic new romantics were predicted to cause more than a stir. Jake was 23 years old, and this tour thus far was the biggest adventure of his life. Growing up in a run-down council house in Romford, alongside friends and family who, considering a day at West the highlight of the calendar year, had not fully prepared him for life on the road. In those days, being a roadie was a career path you literally fell into, as Jake had done when he awoke one morning in the back of a Mercedes Atigo lorry, headed up the M1, wedged between a drum kit and a giant papier-mâché devil's head. His predicament was the result of far too many student union cocktails and badly rolled joints, and his innocent question, where the fuck am I? Was met with much hilarity. So after a few months touring with college bands, rigging the lights, testing sound systems, finding lost plectrums, and heaving the necessary equipment for a gig around the country, Jake was given a golden opportunity from rock impresario and former Sex Rockets manager Martin McRowan. Millie and the Meows, in case it isn't obvious, consist of one girl, conveniently named Millie, and three boys, Eddie, Steve and Barry. The combined age of the band added up to 64, just about one whole pensioner. Jake, at 23, was the daddy of the group and took his surrogate parental responsibility seriously. On the East Coast, the band were a success. Manhattan loved them. The cool New Yorkers went mad for lime green Mohicans and peacock feathered tasseled hats. They adored the gaudy face makeup and vibrant mismatched clothing. Why be seen in boring Gap when you could come as a medieval court jester in high heels? But the Midwest, well, that was a whole different ball game. When the bus rode into San Antonio, folk drew their blinds and the church-going community stood side by side, picketing the venue, signs held aloft exclaiming loudly, sinners music! God hates fags! Real men don't wear makeup! And other welcoming phrases. This is going to be fun, murmured Steve nervously as he chilled in his roll-up and necked a beer. Don't worry, assured Jake. It's all publicity, even rednecks, like a good tune. The band was not convinced. The venue was a clinical-looking convention centre used primarily for barn dances and weddings and, naturally, conventions. It didn't have the requisite atmosphere for a decadent new romantic ball. But nonetheless, a few punters in makeshift London look clothes stood in the vast hall like lonely bowling pins awaiting a strike. The motley crowd of fans, for want of a better word, sang along and swayed to the Meows' big hit, I Want Lemonade. And even the convention centre manager, a big-handed man named Leroy, resplendent in obligatory cowboy hat and leather waistcoat, nodded as he fetched up ice-cold bottles of Coke. Apart from Jake, they were all under 21, so no alcohol was allowed when on the premises.
Not bad, kids. Different. I'm nervous, man, myself, but I appreciate your guts dressing up like it's Halloween.
After the gig, the band had managed to sneak into a local bar just as the doorman took one of his hourly fag and piss breaks. The lone rifle was tawdry, dusty, and distinctly unfriendly. The band huddled together at the further regions of the room, knocking back the bourbon and cokes Jake had bought them. After a few minutes, the atmosphere changed, and the unfriendliness graduated to aggression. A chair clattered across the wooden floorboards, kicking up a cloud of sawdust, quickly followed by the sound of fist hitting face. Spurting red, arced overhead as the blood vessels of the targeted nose cannonballed from the wound. "Let's get out of here," ordered Jake, as he rounded up his underage charges. The London crew legged it down the narrow staircase with the tormenting cries of "Kill the faggots!" echoing in their ears. "Go, go, 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 go!" shouted Jake, looking around briefly to see two Hulk Hogan lookalikes lunging after him with broken bottles in their hands. Just then he felt someone grab his arm. "This way," she said, and he followed the beautiful young woman as she dragged him into a side room and out a fire escape exit onto the roof of the bar. From the top he saw the band running all the way back to the safety of the hotel. Jake leant back on the railings and took the cigarette offered by his protector. "Are you okay, honey?" Jake nodded. He could hear the ruckus below spilling out onto the street and was relieved he'd only had a bird's eye view of the ongoing carnage. "Yeah, thanks," he managed. God, she was lovely. Brown sugar Barbie body squeezed into a shiny red plastic dress that ended mid-thigh, leaving a gorgeous gap of fishnet black until meeting the top of a stiletto patent leather black boot. Over the dress she wore a green velvet jacket with sequins spelling out the words, "I love rock and roll." "Wow. I'm Candy," she purred, "very pleased to make your acquaintance." After brief introductions, Jake accepted the offer of a nightcap at her apartment just a few blocks away. Why the hell not? The kids, as he referred to the band, were safe tucked up in the hotel, and surely he deserved a little R&R. Back at the apartment, Candy's turntable provided the ambience supplied courtesy of George Benson's Give Me the Night. She poured two large whiskies over skull and crossbone-shaped ice cubes. God knows where she'd managed to purchase such a heathen object in a city twinned with an evangelical Western theme park. "I like English boys," she said. "They're softer. They're more like what a lady likes. They possess all the qualities that I would expect in a gentleman." Jake's jeans bulged as his penis stiffened against the denim. God, she was gorgeous. He watched breathless as she slowly unzipped the dress. Then they were released, beautiful chocolate-coloured breasts, almost too perfect. She circled her nipple with her fingertip and drew an invisible line from breast to breast before leaning over and gently kissing him on the lips. At this point, Jake heard the starter's gun go off in his head and there was no turning back. The pair fell onto the dainty floral sofa and writhed about like fighting desert serpents. Candy defty and did his fly, and within seconds placed her lush cherry lips around his cock and got to work. Jake fell back in ecstasy, pulling at her fishnet tights, desperate to touch this angel of the Alamo as intimately as he could. But what the fuck was this? Shit! Jake jumped away in horror as the truth revealed itself. Poor Jake, as much as his manhood, was obviously voting against his wishes. He pulled himself away from her mouth and hastily dressed. Candy instinctively cowered in the corner of the sofa as she wiped at her mouth. I'm sorry, please don't hurt me, she pleaded. Jake was reeling from the shock. Part of him did want to hit her, but he knew he couldn't. "Well, it's fine, I just wouldn't have come back if I'd known, that's all." "They all say that," he said, her eyes resting on his now limp penis. "I've got to go," he said, and hurried to the door. Over 30 years later, Jake still tells this story of mistaken gender to a mixed reception. Some hoot with laughter and slap him on the back. Others pull faces and gag in disapproval. But Jake often wonders whether Candy survived that brutal place and what would have become of him if she hadn't been his saviour that night. Angel of the Alamo by Julie Bellew. Thank you very much. Fantastic story.
This next story is by Keith Large and it's called Kieran Bangs the Drum. Kieran kicked the snare drum across the rehearsal room. It smashed against the wall and bounced into the centre of the floor. Then he stamped on the picture of Steve. His face had advertised the trio's last gig together. Danny and Kieran never got a look in. Not when it came to deciding where they played and how much for. "Good job he's gone," spat out Danny. "Okay, playing for free for his workmates," replied Kieran. "He's right.
We can't play another gig for nothing. I knew your side with him, answered Kieran. Danny battled to put the cover over his bass guitar. Kieran picked up the printout of Hobson's offer. 2 one-hour sets and free coke with ice during the interval. Come on, Kieran, he's not even offering us any grub. Can't even get excited about guessing whether the cheese sandwiches will be out of date or not. It's where Deb goes, replied Kieran. Oh, I should have known. Talk about won't let go. She's not with him now, you know. Danny left the cover half over his bass and reached for his iPhone. There was no substitute to searching on Safari for delving into the past of Kieran's long-term obsession. When Lord Moneybag swept off her feet, she was Deborah.
Debbie, when she was shagging the singer in the Neverbees,
moaned Kieran. Lowering herself again if she's trying to pull out Hobson's cave.
She's still after a bit of rock and roll, believe me,
said Kieran. She could go for Steve.
And it would be our last gig.
You know, if she does agree to play for free, he'd be out to make up for it. Kieran pulled the microphone stand towards his drum chair and sat behind his drum kit.
If I was to sing, we wouldn't need him.
He plays a guitar as well.
But if we're not being paid, we only need a bass and drum.
Danny smiled and walked towards the retro synthesizer, looking friendless in the corner. He grabbed its electric lead and glared at the plug. Don't think this has been pat tested.
Who cares? We can do some 80s electro, replied Kieran.
If you tell Steve he's sacked, smiled Danny.
Kieran punched the air and nodded with delight. Then he found his mobile phone.
You messaging him now? Asked Danny.
The speed of Kieran's fingers texting answered the question.
What'd you put?
Three's a crown and we don't need an egotistical, temperamental prima donna.
Glad you told him, laughed Danny.
Get rid of that crap name. Steve Believes K and D Band,
said Kieran as his mobile phone vibrated. That'd be him, shouted Danny.
Kieran looked at the incoming message.
Hands off the Hobson's gig, you tuneless twats.
You can have it, replied Danny.
No, I can't. I want to impress Debs,
demanded Kieran. Better get programming this synth then, said Danny, plugging it into the wall socket.
3 hours' rehearsal of Kieran forgetting the words led Danny to arguing a drum machine and a synthesizer was enough to provide a beat to entice Debs onto the dance floor.
Hold on. The drum machine's got rid of me drums. If I don't sing, I've got nothing to do,
pleaded Kieran. You could be like Bez out of Happy Mondays.
Spend the whole gig dancing around on stage.
Well, do a Robbie Williams, get Deb out there with you, persuaded Danny.
Kieran smiled at the idea.
I'll contact Hobson's now.
Hold on. I'm not agreed to play for free, replied Danny.
You've got to, or Steve will get the gig.
He's not got a band.
He'll get a karaoke machine.
I want paying or I'm not playing, seeing as I'm now the main man making the music.
Kieran picked up the bass drum and threatened to smash it on top of the synthesizer.
Daddy, don't go all deluded on me.
I want more than you offer me than an out-of-date sandwich.
10 pints and a pizza, because I'm going to pull Debs.
Danny held out his right hand. Kieran put down the bass drum and shook on the deal. If he was now paying Danny in beer and mozzarella toppings, he was going to choose the duo's new name. He texted Hobson's to confirm. Kieran Bangs a Drum would be appearing. He spent the hours leading up to the gig in front of his bedroom mirror, deciding whether it was more rock and roll trying to impersonate Elvis or Mick Jagger, or whether their dance moves far too fast for an 80s synthesizer that couldn't keep up with a 7-inch version of Blue Monday. Danny and Kieran arrived at Hobson's Cave to see a poster on the door. Tonight's doubleheader featuring Steve Believe and Kieran Bangs a Drum.
He's gate crushed our gig, shouted Danny.
Worse, he's headlining, replied Kieran.
I'm not going in, I'm not supporting him, insisted Danny.
You got to. Deb's put on her Facebook she's intending.
20 points and 2 pizzas? Demanded Danny. With unlimited pepperoni. But the show's got to go on, begged Kieran. Danny carried his synthesizer through the half-painted double doors and headed down the dimly lit stairs to the man-made cave below. Kieran followed behind, looking over his shoulder in case Steve was down to soundcheck at the same time.
You know, you're only doing one set now, don't you?
Greeted the mean, muscular figure of Hobson's door manager.
We're professionals. We can deal with it,
replied Kieran.
Make sure you are. I don't want any of you chatting up the punters.
Are you being serious?
Asked Kieran.
Him who's topping the bill told me what you two are like.
How does he know we're playing? Asked Danny.
Your mate there's been direct messaging his girlfriend on Twitter.
Steve's seen Debs!
Shouted Kieran as he banged his fist through the drum machine. All right. Thank you, Keith. Oh, brilliant. Kieran bangs the drum. Okay, so it's me again. And this last story for the night is called The Tracks of My Beers by Silvana Maimone. I hope I said your name right. I've always been a procrastinator, never a procreator. So this is definitely a first for me. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are. Up above the sky so high, like a diamond in the sky. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are. How I wonder what you are. I wonder if there is a new star in the sky tonight. If what Sam says is true, which it probably isn't, because Sam believes that there exists reptilian elite to control the world, and that Elvis still walks among us. But let's say, just for argument's sake, that's what Sam said is true, then there is a star in the sky for every living human in this crazy, overcrowded, soon-to-be dust bowl. Does that mean there are more stars over China? Unless, I don't know, over the South Pole? Must remember to ask Sam about that. He's got an answer for everything. Yeah, Sam. Why was I thinking about Sam? Look at the stars. Twinkle, twinkle. Oh, yeah, yeah. If what Sam says about the stars is true, tonight in the sky there will be a new star. For my daughter, Laura Louise, born with the sunrise. Cassie named her, which is just as well. I wanted to call her Delilah, just so that when I pick her up from school, I can stand at the gate and sing, My, 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 Delilah. What am I doing? What have I done? What on earth made me think that I could be a father? I mean, a father gives guidance, good advice, protects. Give me a sign, old twinkling stars above. Give me a little sign that I deserve to be a father. I will be a good father. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you... Cassie. How I love that girl. Halloween, me and Sam decided to go to a goth club. Made sense to us. Sam turns up in a long black wig, leather, look, trousers and a couple of chains from his shed. I decided to go as a Deucet priest. Floor-length black robes, dog collar, big crucifix, the whole bit. We arrive at Satan's Hideaway. No one bats a heavy black eyeliner ring eye. Not until I get a few tequilas down me and start going around blessing the miserable-looking one-pound shop version Marilyn Manson wannabes. I hope that at least one of them has a sense of humour, even just welcomes the opportunity to test the resilience of the 5 layers of talcum powder in their face by simply hinting at a smile. But no. Not to be discouraged, I approach the group sitting down dark corners, asking them if they want to confess their sins. This seemed the right thing to do at the time. Failing to get even just one confession, but with bones intact and all teeth present and accounted for, I go to the bar for another drink. While waiting to be served, I asked Morticia Adams for her phone number so that maybe later we could have a devilish time in her coffin. She throws her Bloody Mary all over me and slithers off, her long black taffeta skirt leaving a hissing trail as she goes. I look up from the gloopy, dripping mess travelling down my roads to be greeted by the only pair of alive eyes within silver bullet range. I think you might be in need of some holy water, she says, stifling bubbles of laughter. Working behind the bar gives her sanctuary. And so I met and fell in love with Cassie. And yes, of course, we fell out sometimes. Who doesn't? But the most important thing is that each time we returned to each other, and each time the furrow deepened and deepened till we both saw that we had struck gold. We were at one of those stupid fun fairs which always looks fun from the outside and unfair from the inside. Everything costs 3 times more than normal, with 5 times more crap. Soft toys with limbs falling off. Hot dogs with one end shriveled, dry and wrinkly, like the vendor's eyes, and probably just as tasty. I thought I was hungrier. I wasn't really thinking, even though in the end I only managed a couple of mouthfuls. For the whole day, I couldn't stop staring at Cassie. And even more noteworthy, for the whole day, I was almost completely silent. We wandered around, me feeling as confused and bewildered as a kitten in a tumble dryer, her laughing at the badly disguised decay that surrounded us. And we're waiting in line for the 100-foot sheer drop that is the plunger meter of death. She looked suspiciously into my eyes and asked if I'd taken any drugs last night. No, I said, not last night. And after we strapped ourselves into our seats and were waiting for the ride to start, we held hands and locked gazes. I fell into her eyes, and as we plunged 100 feet, I screamed like a captive in a bubbling cauldron being eaten alive by cannibals, "Will you marry me?" Our wedding. Let's just say that an official wedding album doesn't exist. Sure, Cassie's parents had their own version, all flower girls and elderly menu. Firstly, they just didn't appreciate the Groucho Marx glasses and moustache combo I put on for the wedding pictures. Especially as Alan, Cassie's father, is a spitting image of Groucho, though unfortunately with a humour bypass and a double heart bypass the year before. Ellen, her mother, is a prized Rhode Island redhead, always by his side, picking at the lint that only she can see, or whatever item of clothing Alan has chosen to wear. Secondly, I think my foot's asleep. Did I drift off then? What was I thinking about? Look at the stars. Twinkle, twinkle, little star. My little baby girl, Laura Louise. Ah, my little Laura Louise. Twinkle, twinkle. According to Sam, our future is also written in the stars. If I could read them, I'm sure they'd say that I've gone off the rails more than once and likely to do so once again. And me, now a father. Ba, ba, bla. No, that's the wrong one. Where have the stars gone? Oh, I'm an idiot. Such an idiot. Just my eyes closed. Open your eyes. The end. The Tracks of My Beards by Savannah Maimone. Brilliant. Thank you very much. Well, that's it. It's a long one.
Yeah. Lovely collection of rock and roll stories. I suggest you maybe go and listen to the Sex Pistols now to get yourself nicely off to sleep.
Yeah, lovely. And our next live gig is on the October the 31st.
Friday, October the 31st.
Which is Halloween. The theme is Halloween. So we're asking for submissions. The usual address at areyousittingcomfortably@live.com, where you can send your submissions, 1,000 words, around that time.
On the theme of Halloween. Broadly on the theme of Halloween. We have got cakes made by an actual witch, a screaming competition, and some tricks or treats and the usual mischief.
Great.
So look forward to seeing you there.
And happy Halloween when you come along, and see you soon.